Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. Fresno City officials want to give it another try. Will the talk of consolidating Fresno City and county law enforcement end up being more than just talk? Plus, what's behind the spike in California gasoline prices and why it could be back to normal by the end of the week? And painting up the streets in Bakersfield. But first, the Fresno City Council has voted to spend $50,000 to hire a consulting firm to study whether consolidating Fresno Police Department and the Fresno County Sheriff's Office would indeed result in savings. The consultants would study the budgets and operations of both departments, searching for areas where both departments might share duties. Is this a serious effort or a negotiating ploy? We talked to the president of the powerful Fresno Police Officers Association, Jackie Parks. Thank you, Mr. Parks, for joining us today to discuss this issue. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
First of all, you know, the city has brought up the proposal to consolidate city and county law enforcement agencies in the past. Now, what is your reaction to this latest plan to hire a consultant to see if it will indeed save money?
Well, our first reaction is that it's a waste of $50,000 that we need at the police department to do essential services for the community. The services that provide more safety for the community and more safety for our officers.
Well, what if the study shows that there are ways to save money by consolidating the departments or even some of the services within the departments? Would the Fresno Police Officers Association or the union, would they consider it then?
Well, I think we have to really look at what this study is, and they're really trying to downplay it as, hey, guys, it's just a study, nothing to be alarmed at, but let's really realize what it is. It's not just a study. It's a political tool. That's what it is right now. I don't see them talking about the realities of consolidation. And this is why consolidation has been so difficult. It's not as simple as what you would think as the layperson or as the everyday citizen that's driving to work and paying their taxes and expects public safety services. This is very complicated. You have sheriff deputies and you have city police officers. Typically, sheriff deputies, and this is the case for Fresno County, they don't do a lot of traffic operations, which means they don't write a lot of traffic tickets. They don't write any DUIs. They don't write any traffic collisions. They don't need to do that. Essentially, they are basically trained during the academy, but that's it. Where a city police officer in their everyday duties, they write the traffic collisions. They write DUIs, and they do a lot of traffic enforcement. On the flip side, the city officers, they're not trained other than at the basic police academy in custodial functions, which is the largest part of what the deputy sheriffs do is custody at the jail and then the court systems.
Then what you're saying is no matter how you look at it, it would be very hard to consolidate the services because you both have different functions.
Well, yes, we have a common function of public safety, and if you look at the breakdown, and that's what's really important, is you look at the breakdown of the personnel at the sheriff's department, it's probably a little over one-third of the sheriff's department are patrol deputies or law enforcement deputies that are out in the field that conduct investigations, that are patrolling like a city police officer. But the rest of the personnel are civilian employees or are jail deputies or work as bailiffs in the courts.
The whole issue of consolidation, you call it a political ploy. Do you think that using it as a negotiation tool, is that what you're saying?
I do. I think this is really nothing more than a desperate grasp perhaps from the city council to maybe fire a shot across the bow of the FPOA because they are looking for funds. As we know, they had looked for concessions for this year. They balanced a budget on concessions, passed a budget on concessions, and then refused to accept the concessions that the FPOA offered them for the $5.7 million because of it included a one-year extension.
And also they were saying if they would have done that, they really wouldn't have saved any money in the long run. And I think what their argument is now is that the concessions end up costing them more money in the long run.
And that's a wise tale. Let's look at it. Our contract for the FPOA runs through 2015. When the contract comes open, everything is open, everything is on the table, and the city understands that, and so does the FPOA. That's the case every time a contract comes open. But there's no predetermined amount of money. What they're saying publicly is it's going to cost the city $10 million to take the now 5.7, and that's not true. First of all, we need the money right now. That's what we were doing. We're finding a fix for right now. And as we go along, if we would have needed more money next year or the following year as we continue, the FPOA has a history and a pattern of always coming to the table, even though we don't have to, and discussing it. So the $10 million is just a number they pulled out of thin air. That number doesn't exist unless they just say it does. And then let's really look at what that means. That means in 2015, they're saying they would have taken $10 million just from the Police Officers Association, which would equate to somewhere around 12% to 14% of salary value, which is pretty huge compared to what they have been able to take because contracts have come open for other city employees and they've been taking anywhere from 3 to 5. So that isn't very logical for my members. But the reality is as we get closer to 15 and we're talking, you know, several years away, that's when they would have that opportunity, and they still would have that opportunity. And what they're saying is they would have to wait 12 more months for that opportunity or do what we've always done, and you come and you meet with the FPOA and we work out an agreement to try to help the city out.
But, you know, when you really look at the reality of the situation, it's not just the city of Fresno, but a lot of cities facing difficult budget times. And all of those cities, most cities will tell you that the majority of their general fund budget in the city of Fresno, they say it's 80% or more, goes for the employee salaries and their compensation packages. So when you look at a situation where you have to cut, isn't that one of the only places they have left? And when you look at the city of Fresno, they have eliminated entire departments. They have consolidated departments. A lot of people have already lost their jobs. So I think they're looking at this one area and saying, look, we need you to give. We can't continue business as usual.
But yet we do continue business as usual. And I think it's important to look at when you mentioned an important point that all these – there are several cities, not just in California, but across our nation that are struggling. Particularly in California, some of the cities that are struggling, it is because of pension plans and because of the high cost of medical. And that's not the situation with Fresno. We have the number one pension system. We're 120% funded. We have a system where our employees cap at 75%, not 80, not 90, not 100. We already have a three-year average. Everything that was just passed in the governor's pension reform is pretty much where the city of Fresno has been. We didn't have that elaborate 3% at 50 system. We also, on the healthcare side, we don't have healthcare after we retire. Officer Brian Nieto, who was shot and left to die in the street by the bad guys and luckily fought through his injuries and survived, medically retired. He does not have medical insurance because he can't afford it. Now, anything related to his shooting injuries, he's covered under the workers' comp laws. But he no longer has health care. If he falls off his roof or gets a cold or develops cancer or something, he doesn't have insurance because he can't afford it. the employees at Fresno, we've always paid some portion of that. And right now we have an 80-20 split. And again, we don't have health care after we retire. So we don't have those costs, those problems. So where did our problems, our downfalls come? And it comes from the self-imposed deals that the city got themselves involved in. And that's what's making it more difficult for some of the employee groups to just outright give up something, because the damage wasn't done from the cost of the employee. And now that they've laid off and we've attrited 111 officers from the city of Fresno, where are those savings? We've lost 111 officers in the last 2 years. We lost another 200-plus city
civilian
employees.
Would that be when
employees.
They retired, they just weren't replaced? Is
yes.
that what you're looking at?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we've lost another 200-plus civilian employees just from the police department. Where are the savings that we should be accruing from that?
And you're right about the savings. But on the other hand, Fresno City, like a lot of the other cities, were all impacted by the recession. So they weren't getting as much money in as well, to be fair, as far as what they're doing. I think everybody agrees some bad decisions are made by the city and people are paying for it. But on the other hand, when you look at long term, when you look long term down the road, city employees and especially our public safety officers were always given a very good deal. I mean, people believed in doing that. They believed officers deserved it. You're out there protecting the public. People felt strongly about that. But when you look at the reality of the times today, and that's just not Fresno, all cities, what if they come into, 2015 and say, look, we can no longer afford some of these benefits that we were happy to give in the good times? You know, at some point, is there going to be a give and take?
Well, absolutely. That's what negotiations are for. There is that give and take at negotiations. But I think it's important that we point out that we have done several concession deals that have saved the city over $20 million. That's just from the FPOA membership since about 2008. Over $20 million in savings from the employees. And this deal would have gave them another $5.7 million. So we haven't just shunned them and said, guys, we don't feel we need to be part of the problem. We've always been part of the solution. The part they don't like is they want us to give more perhaps or give it up for a longer period of time so we don't do this year by year. But our concern is, and just like the public's concern is with elected politicians, is trust. And we don't trust them to do the right thing and put the money in the right places all the time. So what we're saying is the only control we have is we'll come in and we'll talk to you, but we're going to do it year by year so that we control this, so that we can monitor this and that we're only giving what's needed versus giving a lot more, and then they spend more than what they need. And that's our biggest concern.
So what we're looking at are shorter-term contracts in the future.
Oh, definitely. I see that from the city side, and I suspect most contracts will be 1, maybe 2 years. The downside to that is you're always in negotiations from the city side. And you'd mentioned that the public safety has always gotten a good deal. And I'm not going to say that we don't get paid a good salary, because I think we get paid a fair salary. But we certainly, for a city of our size, for the amount of calls for service, the crime rate that we have in the city of Fresno, we are not one of the highest paid law enforcement agencies in the city. We've never had the lucrative benefits that most and probably 80, 90% of public safety, police and fire have enjoyed, the 3% at 50. We've never enjoyed those types of lucrative benefits. We've had fair benefits. We really have. And we understand that. And we're willing to be part of the solution like we always have. But we need to have some control so they just don't spend uncontrollably on pet projects or projects that they're getting ready to term out, and they've got to have that legacy project, something that they can put their name on. We've got to be able to control that and try to help them do what's right for our community. And I caution the citizens, when you look at law enforcement, we don't build widgets. We're a service-oriented organization. And when you get what you're paid, you pay what you get for with service. So it's very important. These guys carry firearms, and they can take somebody's life. And it's very important that the citizens of Fresno get the highest trained, the officers with the best ethics and morals, so that they're not stealing from people when they're doing building searches or house searches, so they're not taking drugs from drug dealers or stealing from drug dealers or hurting other people. And if you want that quality of an officer, and you only have to look, because you go back east, many departments are large departments. They may be a city of our size, and they may have more officers because they pay less. But you look at their internal affairs investigation history of the officers and the trust with that community.
Fresno Police Department has had his share of lawsuits and has had his share of incidents where it's been questioned. So, and that too has cost the city a lot of money. So in that respect.
But in comparison with other cities, we really go down into the basement of costs like that. And let's look at a lot of those. I mean, we had two police officers that were in a narcotics unit that got raked over the coals, were booked into jail. One case was thrown out at the preliminary hearing by the judge. That's unheard of in law enforcement. I've been doing this over 25 years. I have never had an arrest that I have made thrown out at a preliminary hearing. And his case, that's an injustice to that officer who goes out and risks his life. The other officer, he was acquitted on all counts and recently has been promoted. So let's not look at things for what people are accused of, but let's look at the end results. And we got to realize a lot of the lawsuits are nuisance lawsuits, and the city pays them in advance to make them go away because it's cheaper than fining, which upsets my members greatly. But many of those are just nuisance lawsuits.
Well, let's come back around and try to end this again on the consolidation issue. You're saying you think it's just a political move. And again, what if the consultant comes back and says, look, there are some areas where they can share services? Is that something you're willing to consider?
Oh, absolutely. And we've been on the record. We have said all along, we've talked with whether it's the chamber, publicly, we are willing to look at different areas of consolidation. We always have, like, records, dispatch, booking, equipment, facilities. And I think there is possibilities for savings. But there are a lot of things that you have to overcome in those different categories. And it's not as simple as what is being proposed to the public. That's what concerns us, is this is being proposed to the public, and we don't want them to get this false hope or this false sense of, oh, you know, consolidation is going to work. It is extremely difficult. It would be extremely expensive to try to consolidate in full both departments. I believe, as a person on the inside, that there are areas, like I mentioned, in dispatch and records and booking and facilities and equipment that we've missed the boat on because of personalities or personal preference, or the county prefers a .45 versus the city uses a .40 caliber. I don't understand sometimes, and again, it's above my pay grade, why we can't consolidate some of those efforts, because I do believe there are savings there for us. I don't think it's the savings that people expect that's going to be so great that's going to pull us out of, you know, some of our economic woes. But I do think it would be better management. I do think it would have some cost savings. And I think it would help build better relationships between the police department and the sheriff's department.
Okay. Well, there's much more to come on this. We'll follow it and see how it turns out in the end. Again, Jackie Parks, president of the Fresno Police Officers Association, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Juanita.
Well, joining me now is Al Smith, President, Greater Fresno Area Chamber of Commerce, who supports the effort to see if consolidation will work, and Fresno City Councilman Oliver Baines, who is a former Fresno police officer. Thank you both for joining us to continue this conversation.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Juanita, for having me.
Let's start with you, Mr. Smith. Now, this has been attempted before. It's been talked about before. What do you think is different this time, or do you think it's different this time?
Well, you're correct that it's been tried before. It's been tried before a number of times. And the chamber initiated an effort back in 2006 to try to integrate certain services on the premise that there was probably a savings to be had because of some of the things that Jackie just mentioned, which is there are certain areas that we can – that are being duplicated throughout the community in public safety that if combined probably would be more efficient, save us money, and probably create a better sense of cooperation between the two departments, the sheriffs and the police department. Not that they don't get along pretty well now. I think there's more dissension at the top than there is during the public safety areas. So we went through that process in 2006, came out of it. The city council and the board of supervisors agreed to form a joint powers authority after the chamber initiated this $20,000 study. They found 10 areas in which they felt like they could save money. Those savings ranged on the short side to close to $1 million a year in the first initial effort. The committee, the board of supervisors and the council decided that maybe they would take just three of them first and see how this felt. And if it worked, we'll pick on some more. And so we did, and long and short of that is they joined, they formed a joint powers authority between the city and the county, which would be made up of supervisors, members of the public safety, the police and the sheriff's department, and three members of the public, the general community. And they met for a while. They were supposed to be funded by the city and the county, $50,000 each, $100,000 to start it, to then hire someone to run the JPA. The city put up its money. The county budgeted their money but never would appropriate it. Long and short of it is the person was never hired. All of a sudden, some of the elected officials wouldn't show up for the meeting, so we couldn't have a quorum, and it kind of went nowhere and it fell apart.
When you say it kind of went nowhere, you know, in the end, what do you think happened? Did it become
– Well, I think there were some members of the elected area that supported in public but didn't like it in private and quietly undermined the effort. That's my own personal opinion.
What makes you think this time might be different?
I think the landscape is different. I mean, I think the community today – and remember, this was 2006 we did this.
Now,
this
is way before
six, seven years. Well, recession, and I think there's a sense of fear in the community today that we didn't have back then. I think businesses – I mean I know our members in the chamber, we hear horror stories about burglary. I mean it's just – it's not a crime to steal anymore. Just go get it and they'll take you down to the jail and let you out 4 hours later and you're back out stealing from the same guy. And there's a sense of the private citizens who are a little concerned about their safety. So I think there's an underpinning of fear in the community today that says, hey, we better look at this probably a little closer than we have. And that brings us to the possibility that are we doing it as efficiently as we can? And if we aren't, what do we do to change it?
Mr. Baines, how do you respond to this claim, because you are also a member of the Fresno City Council and a former police officer, how do you respond to this claim that this is a negotiation tactic on the part of the city? The way this is usually negotiations have worked in the past is that the two sides come together, they can't agree. The city asks for concessions. Police department gives up something but asks for something else that usually ends up costing the city, you know, more down the road. So as a city councilman, how do you respond to this whole claim that this is a negotiation tactic?
Well, thanks, Juanita, for even asking me that. I don't know that there is really an honest response. I know that's not what we're doing. I know that that's not even factored into the equation. So you know, I know that sometimes there's the real pull to make what we do at City Hall somewhat conspiratorial or theatrical sometimes, but it's really not. This is an honest look from public servants who are charged with being financial stewards of the public's money. And I couldn't think of anything that's further from the truth. You know, this city council and city councils before us, some of our predecessor city councils have really been maligned for some of the decisions made. You mentioned, it was alluded to some of those in the past segment. And I think that if there's one thing that's true, is we got the message. And yes, the idea of looking at consolidation is very difficult. But I'm sure that's not the reason why we should not explore it. We are in an honest effort trying to find out where we can save money, where it makes sense. And this effort is being led by policymakers. Policymakers who are listening to and watching what's happening and going on in our city.
As a former police officer, when you think about, you know, what you did, do you think there are some areas that where both departments could possibly share their services?
Oh, most definitely. I think that there's wide consensus amongst everyone who talks about this, that knows that there are areas where there are duplicative services and areas where we should consolidate. So absolutely. I don't even think that's a question.
Then when you say that, and it's the same with Mr. Smith, why hasn't it happened then before? Because
right.
It seems even with Mr. Parks, and both of you all say, oh, yeah, we think there are areas where we can share duties. What is it going to take to actually get to that point? I'll start with you.
What I'm going to do is segment out both conversations. So we'll take Jackie's position at this point. And Jackie's a friend of mine, so I understand where he's coming from. We disagree on this particular point, but Jackie's only real resistance to this effort involves the idea that we're looking at the whole piece. So, you know, and I understand that the idea of that is fearful. It's fearful for me as well. I mean, I'll be honest with you. But it needed to be looked at. So Jackie's issue isn't that we can't, as I understand it at least, isn't that we can't, there aren't areas of consolidation, but that even looking at the whole piece should be removed from the equation. So me as a policymaker, I understand that position, but obviously I can't subscribe to that. You know, we need the information. We need to know what we're looking at. Now I'm going to move to past efforts. Past efforts are a little bit different because I think Al really walked down the path and described what happened very well, as a matter of fact. And what you heard in that description simply was the age-old issue between the city and the county and some of the inability to cooperate in the past that existed between the city and the county. Now I wasn't on the city county back then, of course, so I can only speculate as to some of what happened. And it would just sound like there were some territorial issues that could not be overcome by policymakers. What happened in the past? That climate, and Al, I thought, did a really good job of just explaining where we are today. That climate between public servants is not the same as it was back then. So I can tell you that this effort being you know, and I want to underscore the fact that, you know, the city council approved this study and approved this path 6-1. It's a very strong statement by the policymakers that we want to explore this. We have obviously reached out to the Board of Supervisors, and although they are reticent, you know, because they've been here before, a lot of them have served a lot longer than most of the members of the councils, but they are open. They aren't shutting the door. We went and, you know, we spoke to the sheriff, who was extremely open. You know, of course, I mean, on the county side, there's some legitimate pause because they've traversed down this path before, And so they're like, well, you know, we'll see where this ends up. They don't have a whole lot of confidence, but at the same time, they're not backing away from the table. So I think this effort this time around materially is starting at a different place, which is very, very important to me, because right off the bat, you have buy-in from the policymakers that are saying, we want to do this. When the policymakers are saying that they want to do it, then that alone gives some momentum to the effort. Like I said, the city council voted 6-1 that we want to do this. So we want to look at this. And I want to respond really quickly to something. I don't even ask it. There are no presumptions in this study, Juanita. I don't think anyone is saying that we're going to that the goal is to consolidate and merge both the sheriff department and the police department. At least we said that publicly. I've told that privately to Jackie and other members of the FPOA and amongst our council. I think we mentioned it from the dais. So I know people may not want to hear that, but we're really coming into this with an open mind without any presumptions. What we know is that there can be savings that have been had. And we know that the last study done in 2006 did not have the scope of this study. And so there it has been suggested maybe that, you know, we've done this study before, we've done this in the past. Well, I can tell you that the scope and breadth of this study is unlike any study we've done before. And we need to get the factual information. You know, not only our constituents, but our bargaining groups, they want us to have the right information. We get charged for not having good information, for having bad numbers, or, you know, making knee-jerk reactions, not understanding the details. You know, we get maligned with those charges pretty regularly. So we're trying to avoid that this time up front by saying, before we make any suppositions as to what can or will happen, what we're going to get in front of us are facts and details. We're going to know what the study says. We're going to understand what we're talking about when we all come to the table and we have the full range discussion.
But you know what? I want to ask Al this. You heard Mr. Baines mention that he thinks the county is ready to cooperate and work together. But even in this situation, the city is the one that is paying for the study. The county said, oh, yes, go ahead, but, you know, we're not going to.
Well, it was. I think it was nice. It felt good to see the sheriff down there when they were considering this issue. At least publicly saying to the council that night or that afternoon, when they looked at this issue, that she would be very cooperative, that she would open up her books, have candid dialogue with everybody, cooperate with the company that's been hired to do this survey. If she stays good to her word, then something good will come out of it. Does she have the ability to probably shut it down? Yeah, I think she does. She sits in a very enviable position on this thing. So I think it's going to be it's nice for her to be in that position to control it. It's also puts her in a position of saying, "Hey, you're part of you need to be a part of the solution, and will you cooperate and help make this happen?" So, and I agree with the councilman. You know, nobody has any preconceived ideas of where this is going to go, but the idea that we I think Councilman Borges called it, we're not looking under rocks, we're looking under boulders, as he put it. But I think it doesn't hurt us to do it. If my numbers are correct, the total budgets between the city and the sheriff's department total about $253 million.
Wow.
That both those departments. In the study that we did in 2006, we found 2-3% savings in almost every one of those categories that we looked at. If that would apply across the 2-3% figure across that total budget, you're talking $7 million a year in savings. That's a lot of money. Now, those were numbers back, so they probably wouldn't be as good today. But it does at least give you an illustration of what the amount of money that we could be, and that's every year we're looking at. So, you know, when you're going to spend $50,000 to see if you can save $7 million, that's not a bad return on your investment.
Right. And in the old study, back in 2006, I think you said you all came up with 10 areas that
right.
you thought you could look at consolidating.
Right. And we actually addressed three of them. We addressed dispatch. We addressed property and evidence storage. And we addressed joint prisoner processing. And some progress was made on all three of those. The dispatch thing got confusing because it was right after the 9/11 thing happened, not too far after that. And where we were trying to combine dispatch, there was a theory posed that, well, really in today's environment, we should always have some redundancy because terrorists could blow up one and we'd be out of business. And that kind of fell on the wayside. But it doesn't stop the idea that the systems that both the sheriff and the police department use for communication should be uniform. And part of the problem we have, maybe even today, but for sure when we were doing the study 6 years ago, was that the police department's system would not communicate with the sheriff's department system. And so and then they could talk to each other verbally, but they couldn't transmit data back and forth. And now where that stands today, I don't know, but I'm told, and Councilman Baines, maybe you can address this, I'm told that they are getting ready to buy a new communication system for the city. Is that correct?
You know, that's what I understand, and I know during the discussion last Thursday, the chief mentioned something similar, that the issue we had with dispatch with communications in 2012, those issues would not exist as they did in 2006. So that's a big step.
Okay, so because for sure, if we're going to buy new equipment, let's make sure that the two sides are talking to each other.
Exactly, right. Because that would be something in the past that would have happened, and then you end up duplicating.
Right.
And that's something I'm sure that as they move forward, they don't want to do. And it seems like even now there's an effort. If there is a way that you can work together and share, that is something that they're trying to do. Well, our time for this segment is up. I appreciate both of you being here today to continue on this. And we'll see how that $50,000 study comes out. I think everybody wants to know in the end. And you're right. I think the city and the county and the public might be ready to look at this in a serious way. So Al Smith, president of the Greater Fresno Chamber of Commerce, and Fresno City Councilman Oliver Baines, thank you both for joining us today.
Our pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, not many of us are saying fill her up these days. That's because it could cost you more than $100 to fill up your gas tank. Californians have seen prices at the pump go up right before their eyes, shooting up 50 cents a gallon in 1 week alone. In some parts of California, motorists are paying more than $5 a gallon. In Fresno, the prices are inching right up there as well. Joining us now to talk about what's behind the spike and when we can expect prices to level off and how to control these swings in prices in the future is Tom Calza, Chief Oil Analyst, Oil Price Information Service. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Juanita. How are you today?
I am great. Well, you know, this price hike is being blamed on refinery capacity. You know, a fire shutting down a major refinery in Richmond, some oil refineries offline for maintenance. Are those the only reasons we saw the prices shoot up the way they did?
That's most of it. This is not related to crude prices, which were really responsible for the 2008 price surge. Crude oil prices have been pretty static between, let's say, $90 and $110 a barrel, and they've remained that during this run-up. You really had a series of unfortunate incidents, most of them pretty minor, but together in the aggregate, very significant. Chevron in Richmond Refinery was more than just an insignificant accident. And then on the weekend, last weekend, you had a power outage that knocked out some ExxonMobil refining for a while. So together, in concert with the fact that the oil business, like a lot of businesses, runs on just-in-time inventories, you had the perfect storm that led to this pricing paroxysm, which I happen to believe is probably over, but which will make for grand theater here in the next couple of days or weeks.
Well, you know, is there a way at all for California to kind of take steps or measures to kind of prevent something like this from happening? I mean, do we get our oil from certain places that kind of makes us vulnerable, or what is the situation?
No, I think to a certain extent this is the price of clean air, and there's no free lunch when it comes to clean air. And California gasoline is the cleanest burning gasoline in the country, and it's difficult to make, and it's made mostly by refiners in the state as well as some in Washington state. And you're geographically separated from other sophisticated plants that can make it by about 3 weeks of waterborne transport time. Now, there probably are going to be some efforts after this to almost regard U.S. refineries in California as utility-like, but I'm not so sure I would be comfortable with that. And there may even be some efforts to say, well, we should have some sort of reserve. We have a strategic petroleum reserve for crude oil. We don't have any strategic petroleum reserves in the country for gasoline. So I think you're going to get an outcry about that. But sometimes, you know, it's a little bit like you flip a coin, and sometimes you'll get six or seven heads in a row. To a certain extent, that's what's happened here. People who want to be responsible, I would urge them to buy responsible vehicles. Don't buy those big, huge SUVs on the thought that, well, oil prices go up, but they always drop, and I like to drive this big, huge, clunky vehicle. And I think ultimately that'll be part of the solution.
But, you know, when it comes to the public, you're so right. I think on one hand, especially here in California, we have made the choice to have cleaner air, and especially for those of us living right here in the valley that has some of the dirtiest air. We see that as a good thing. But then on the other hand, there is always a cost for this. And I think a lot of times people don't think about that.
No, there is no such thing as a free lunch. And unfortunately, and I think this is true with a lot of things beyond energy in this country, that in the last 20 years, we've gone about as far away from the Kennedy quote of ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country kind of way of thinking. No one, you know, everyone wants cheaper products or cheaper gasoline, but no one wants to pay for it, or no one wants to make sacrifice. And that might mean things like sacrificing the size of the vehicles, to a certain extent, some lifestyles. You know, certainly I would never argue against the notion that trying to clean up the air is a bad idea. I think it's a good idea. I think most refiners would probably realize that over time, but you have a very adversarial relationship in the state between the regulators and the refiners. And that's going to come to a head in the next couple of years when you have some regulations related to low carbon footprints and so forth that impact the production of gasoline.
What about Senator Dianne Feinstein's statement as far as calling for an investigation, saying this could have been brought on by illegal manipulation of the market?
Yeah, well, we've seen investigations like that from time to time, and I think under almost all circumstances, we find out that it's not necessarily manipulation or collusion. It is simply capitalism. And there's nothing that moves a product in a free market like fear. And there was substantial fear a week ago that the state might have seen gasoline inventories compromised to where it could run out of fuel, or that more refineries might go down. That fear was largely replaced with a fear in the last couple of days that everything was getting back to normal and that prices were way too high and would drop. So we're left with wholesale prices, which are probably fairly reasonable and probably indicate that the numbers you see this week at the pump may represent the highest numbers you see, certainly for 2012 and perhaps for 2013 and beyond.
So could we see prices go down by the end of the week?
Yes, I think you might see them go down by the end of the week, with the caveat that if another refinery goes down, it's obviously insult to injury. But we've seen a big drop. Last week, we got all the way to $180 for a wholesale price for gasoline, about $4.30 before you add taxes, delivery, anything, credit card markups, and so forth. Yesterday, we dropped all the way to $3.20. And today, we're back up to something in the mid-threes. That would imply a retail price of maybe $4.25 to $4.50. That's not enough to go out and buy a Pope Mobile, but I think it's probably enough to suggest to people that, look, There was a panic. There was a momentary crisis. But this is not part of a secular change.
Okay. Thanks for explaining all of that to us. I appreciate it.
That doesn't ease the price, though. As Ricky Ricardo used to say to Lucy, I got a lot of splaining to do.
Yeah. I think people feel that way, though, about the oil companies. And that's the problem. There's just not a lot of trust there.
No, they love to hate the oil companies. And look, there's a lot of things to distrust and dislike about capitalism, but that's really at work here. And there can be some excesses, and we've seen that on display to a certain extent in the last few months.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Tom Calls, a chief oil analyst, Oil Price Information Service. Thanks so much for putting this all in perspective for us. We appreciate you visiting us today. Thank you. And to continue our discussion, you know, Election Day is still just a few weeks away, but voting in California actually begins this week as counties send out vote-by-mail ballots. Today, we kick off our look at the 11 statewide measures Californians will decide this fall. And we begin with Governor Brown's tax initiative, Proposition 30. Here's Ben Adler.
Aye. Jerry Brown.
Ever since he returned to the governor's office, Jerry Brown has had one overarching goal: end the state's persistent budget deficits by winning voter approval on a tax measure. After failing to reach a deal with legislative Republicans, he turned this year to the biggest staple in California's political playbook.
That's it. All right, guys, let's get them filed.
In May, the governor personally turned in voter signatures to place an initiative on the ballot. Proposition 30 would temporarily raise the sales tax a quarter cent and raise income taxes on the wealthiest Californians. Here's how Brown framed the stakes at a campaign event in August.
It's whether the most privileged and blessed people in our state will pay 1 or 2 or 3% more for 7 years, or we cut 3 weeks of school and take a half a billion from our colleges.
That approach angers Prop 30 opponents.
Hey, lady, hand over your purse so the schools get it.
What?
This radio ad comes from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. President John Kupal says the problem isn't just that the governor is holding schools hostage. It's issues like the state park scandal and high-speed rail.
State government is not a good steward of taxpayer money now, and they have not earned the right to even ask for more money.
One last part of Prop 30 is often overlooked. It would constitutionally protect money for Governor Brown's shift of low-level offenders from the state to counties. But the big focus is on the tax increases and their impact on the state budget. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Our election 2012 coverage continues with a report on Proposition 31. The measure would change California's budgeting process. But as Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, it would do much more than that.
Proposition 31 has been criticized for not going far enough to change California's fiscal environment, for being too complex, and for its possible unintended consequences. James Mayer is the executive director of California Forward, which is pushing Proposition 31.
We explain this to Californians that we've built a new budget process that's really based on best practices in other states. That's 90% of this measure.
Mayer says Prop 31 would end the turmoil of annual budgeting by establishing a two-year performance-based budget. It would require the legislature to define funding sources for new programs or tax cuts costing $25 million or more. The measure would permit the governor to cut the budget unilaterally in fiscal emergencies if the legislature doesn't act.
It's certainly got more words in it than that, and there are more details because you're dealing with law, but that's really what it does. Stabilizes the budget process at the state level and gives some incentives and encouragement to local governments to work together.
Under Prop 31, local governments could develop their own procedures to administer state programs. That has opponents particularly concerned. Tom Adams, co-chair of the No on 31 campaign, fears it could allow local politicians to undermine state laws.
If local governments wanted to preempt the Clean Air Act or preempt provisions of the Clean Water Act or change Medi-Cal eligibility standards, they would be able to do these things.
The measure would also require the legislature to make bills public at least 3 days before a vote. All of the changes would amend California's constitution. Republicans, for the most part, support the measure. Democrats generally do not. At the state capitol, I'm Amy Quinton.
That was Amy Quentin reporting from the state capitol. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, when is it okay to paint the town red or any other color, for that matter, during the Via Arte Street Painting Festival in Bakersfield? Here to tell us more about this annual event is Jason Gutierrez, Marketing Director, Bakersfield Museum of Art. Thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Gutierrez.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, let's talk about this. It sounds like it is so much fun. And you've been doing this for a while as well.
We have been doing this for a while. In fact, we've been doing it for 14 years. It's going to be our 14th year at the Marketplace here in Bakersfield. And like you said, when is it appropriate to paint the town? We're actually hoping to not only paint it red, but blue, but green and purple, and all the colors you could possibly think of, as we have artists from around California, around the country, and even local artists, high school, adult age, even children, elementary school age, painting with chalk the asphalt of the Marketplace.
And that's great for people who may not know. The Marketplace is a Bakersfield version of River Park. So think of an area like that and all these artists out there painting up the sidewalk. And, you know, how long does the artwork get to stay?
That's kind of a sad thing. I mean, coming from my perspective, we have these masterpieces on the sidewalk, on the pavement out there, and they're going to get pressure washed on Monday. So you actually get to
only
see
for a weekend.
It's only one weekend, so you get to see the process from start to finish, and then it's gone. It's back to normal.
And this is also a project for some of the schools, some of the students who get to participate in this, isn't it?
Yeah, all of the 4x6 squares that are sponsored by individuals and businesses go to local high schools here in Kern County. And the students come out with their high school art teachers, and they create masterpieces. And it kind of inspires them to keep that artistic edge, to keep them pushing to move their skills forward as they see the professional artists work right beside them.
And who is your featured artist this year? Because you feature an artist every year at this.
Correct. This year it's going to be Laurel Miller. Laurel has actually participated in Via Arte years ago before I was at the museum. And now she's gone out, she's traveled the country, she's worked in many other chalk art festivals, and she's really owned her skills, and she does beautiful work, and she's going to be our featured artist here this year, working on the largest square at Via Arte.
Now, this is also a fundraiser, isn't it? Because, as you mentioned, some of the squares, they're sponsored.
Correct. We do a lot of pre-sale before we sell the squares to different businesses, to individuals here in Kern County. And then we also provide the opportunity for parents or guardians to bring their smaller children to the festival, and they're able to purchase what we call Via Bambino squares. And they're small squares that the kids can sit down and create in their own artistic skills.
I mean, isn't that great? I think all of us as children, I can remember being given some chalk and being able to go out on the sidewalk. And just to have that freedom to create, starting at such a young age, because you're really, you know, instilling the love of art in young people, starting at a very early age.
Yeah, I mean, I too remember loving to have my big tub of chalk and going out and drawing and creating. For me, it was comic book superheroes, but kids love to draw everything from cartoons to landscapes to animals. It's really cool and it's inspiring, even for people who are not artistic, to see kids use their imagination in such a way.
Now, tell us a little bit about this for people who might want to attend.
Yeah, for everyone that wants to come to and attend, we highly encourage it. And in fact, this event to come to is free, and everybody loves a good time for no money. So you get to come out, and you get to see the artists create their works of art. It is at a large shopping center, so there's food provided by restaurants. There's live entertainment provided by local bands, there's belly dancing, there's balloon animals for the kids. There, again, there's the Via Bambino squares that parents can purchase for their kids. So it's an overall wonderful afternoon. And looking at the forecast here in Bakersfield, it's going to be a nice, cool weekend.
It sounds like lots of fun and just a great time for everybody. Just a little bit about how did this all get started?
This all got started back a while ago, before I was there for sure. The museum wanted to create an event to remember. And looking around at what's already been done, bringing a traditional Italian street painting festival such as Via Arte to Bakersfield had never been done. So why not mark some new territory and create something new for the community? So the museum curator and the museum director at the time thought this was one of our signature events, and it's continued to grow and produce great money for the museum, which is a local nonprofit organization. And the community loves it, and they supported it tremendously over the years.
Okay, sounds like great fun and a great weekend. Jason Gutierrez with the Bakersfield Museum of Art, thanks so much for joining us. And this sounds like a great event this weekend.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.